Two Dimension Comic Book Podcast, Episode 3. Hey folks, and welcome to Two Dimension Comic Podcast, the podcast with no direction. This is our third episode, and we're going to be continuing our talk of comic book writers. I am your host, Dallas Busha. And with me is...
Brooke.
And Don.
What's up, guys? Well, thanks for joining us, everybody. Jumping right into things. Last episode, if you listened, we were talking about comic book writers, and we were going over a list of our favorite writers and the ones that have made a big impact in our lives and our comic reading experiences. And we were talking about Rooks, and we got off topic pretty quickly, so I kind of want to continue. Hey, that's a good thing, though.
It's easy for us to do.
Well, I want to continue with the list, though, and kind of going down the line, Rook, who are some of your other comic book writers, some of your favorites?
You know what, I actually think we've pretty much covered everybody except for one more, Jim Krueger, which if everybody knows, very known for being with Alex Ross, with doing the Justice series with DC, and of course the Earth X, Universe X, Paradise X stuff.
I affectionately refer to him as the Krugs.
Yeah.
Made that up just now.
Yeah, you almost picture him wearing like the red and black striped sweater as he's writing. Yeah. Little fedora.
Yeah.
But yeah, excellent writer. I mean, both of those series, the X series and the Justice series, amazing storylines. And that's a lot of what I like to read too. Sometimes is the Elseworlds series, the Elseworlds storylines, stuff that has no bearing in the mainstream universes of the big companies, and so it can be far out there. It can be extreme as it wants to sometimes, and you can have characters dying or dead or aged, and you get a different sense of them. So I really enjoy stories like that.
Some of the best or the most popular mainstream stories are Elseworlds stories, like Miller's The Dark Knight Returns.
Oh yeah, if you want to talk about Elseworlds stories that are just amazing, Red Son. I mean, Superman Red Son is probably one of my number one recommended reads to anyone. That it's a great storyline. And, of course, there's also another one for Superman, which I cannot remember the title of, but where he landed on Apocalypse and was raised by Darkseid.
Mm.
That's another good one as well. So,
a Red Son, is that the one where he landed in Russia?
Yeah, when he was raised by
Stalin.
I've
heard of it.
Oh, great book. Great book. I think I have a copy. I'll let you borrow it.
I would like to. So. I've heard of it, but I've just heard somebody talk about it.
Will you let all our readers borrow it, too?
Yeah, all five people listen to the show.
I have to say, though, I've never really had the pleasure of reading Jim Krueger's work, and if I have, I don't recognize it.
Well, that's one of the things that I think a lot of people have with Krueger is because Ross is seen as the main guy for those stories. But if you actually pay attention, you read to the people that worked on the book, he did the script. So, Alex Ross and him were the ones that worked on those books. Many other people as well, of course. But, those are some really, really good books right there as well.
Yeah, I might have to check them out now just because of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I would recommend it. So.
Cool.
All right, well, just kind of jumping down the line. Don, do you want to go next or should I?
I'll go next.
All right.
I want to set this up first. One time in 1982, I was at a convention in Dallas, Texas, and I heard Jan Stronaut and Gary Groth in a panel talking about, comic books and the state of them. And Jan Stronaut, who's a writer, had mentioned that artwork is what, propels a story. Artwork can save a bad story. And he was kind of talking remorsefully about it. I'm thinking, well, of course. I never bought any comic book because of the writer. I always bought it for the art. And one time I heard a guy talking about an animated TV show in the 80s, and something I thought was kind of neat, and it got canceled after the first season. And he said the reason why was the kids wanted stories, and there wasn't really any story to it. And I thought, oh, okay. I started understanding what he meant by that. There are certain stories I did like quite well, but I never paid attention to the writers. So when you mentioned this topic, I started thinking of my favorite writer, and like everything, I overthink everything. And the first person I'd ever choose would be Carl Barks. He did all the Donald Duck and Uncle Scrooge stories. When I was a kid, a guy that lived next door to me gave me a stack of comics, and it had a bunch of Walt Disney stuff. I was interested in Superman, Batman, that type of stuff, and I was just going to toss them. I ended up reading a couple. I didn't like all the stories, but there were certain ones. I said, man, this guy, he really draws well. His stories were always compelling. It always stayed with me. I think I was in high school years later when I found out that was Carl Barks.
Well, let me interject just real quick. I know a lot of books at the time, those style of books, like a lot of maybe the Archie books and things, they didn't always give credit to the writers and artists.
No, never.
Was he kind of an unknown at the time, and did he get famous like after the fact?
Yeah, he was. They were all signed Walt Disney. You know, they were just blank. The way I found out who he was, again, I always referred to him as the guy that drew good, because he just, they were all the Disney style, but you could tell he had done it. And his stories were always unique. And I think it was 77 or 78. I was in a comic store, and the guy was telling me about that was Carl Barks. And he says he did it all. Really? Well, then later on I found out it was true. A company called Gladstone, another Rainbow, they were putting out all the color volumes of it. And they were talking. There was a philosophy professor in Berkeley, California. And he was using those comic books to teach his students. And he was the one that, I guess, him and a couple other guys got a hold of Carl Barks through Western Publishing and found out who he was. And that's where the name started getting out. But he was always working like a lot of these guys, you know, nobody knew who they were. But he was the one I wanted to choose. But then I started thinking about it. If Carl Barks didn't draw the story, if he wrote it for somebody else, I probably wouldn't have gone and bought it. The other one I was thinking of that I always felt was my favorite was Gilbert Hernandez of Love and Rocket City. I always loved the stories. Certain stories like The Heartbreak Soup just always stayed with me. I always think of those.
Well, that's another example of what we talked about last episode when we were talking about Rook and his Robert Kirkman Walking Dead. Is that's a long-running story, The Love and Rockets, and that's something that pays off in the long run because you watch the characters mature and change and go through different events in their lives.
Yeah, and you really feel for the characters and what happens in the stories. So I was wanting to stay with those, but I thought, you know, if Gilbert Hernandez wrote a story for somebody else, I may not buy it. So
I feel like we need a drum roll for this or something.
Well, I started thinking about, I always like artist-writer combinations. And, you know, I started thinking about one of your favorites, Chris Claremont. I love Chris Claremont, you know, in the late 70s and early 80s. He and John Byrne did all this work on Marvel Team-Up, Iron Fist, you know, and then they did some of the Power Man Iron Fist stuff.
Right.
And, you know, of course, the X-Men. I loved it. It all kind of tied in. It was all moving, and I just thought they were a great team. The artwork, the stories, you know, and it was, they did it together. They both inputted all kinds of stuff, but what they were able to achieve just blew my mind. But then when they stopped working together, I mean, I read stuff Chris Claremont wrote and liked it, but I've read stuff he wrote with other people, and it was good, but I never bought a book because Chris Claremont wrote it. So the other one I would add to it is Gardner Fox. He wrote all those science fiction stories for DC, Strange Adventure. I think he might have written some...
Did he do Green Lantern?
I think he wrote... I don't know if he wrote all of them, but I think he wrote a lot of those Flash and Green Lantern stories, some of them. But he was one as a kid, I always remembered I liked his stories. But again, I never would have bought a book solely because of him. So I started thinking about the criteria. There's a lot of writers I do like, but I only bought them because I like the artwork done to it.
Yeah.
So, and I hate to say this, Alan Moore would be the one that I would say.
Well, let's say Alan Moore.
It is Alan Moore again. And I've always liked Alan Moore, but I never read a Swamp Thing's thing until Dallas had lent it to me. Miracle Man was the first thing I'd ever picked up and read.
Have you read that, Rook?
I think I started to at one time, and I cannot remember for the life of me why I didn't finish it. Me neither. Something was going on.
Well, next time we meet, you'll be reading it, because when you loan me the Red Krypton, or Red Sun,
yeah.
I'll be bringing you the Miracle Man.
Sounds good.
But I couldn't get past the first couple of issues of what he wrote, and oh my God, and the artwork was phenomenal. It was Gary Leach started it, and then later Alan Davis came in, one of my favorites, and he did them. But it's just how the stories went, and it made you think, and, you know, and then later when Watchmen came out, it was amazing, but I just found with Alan Moore, anything he wrote, I'd buy the book because he did it. Sometimes I didn't always like the artist he worked with. You know, I mean, it wouldn't be a style I liked. They were always good, but it wouldn't be something I normally go for. But I always picked it up because he wrote it, and it always amazes me that each story is completely different. Probably my favorite stuff, besides the Miracle Man and the Watchmen stuff, was he did a Captain Britain storyline with Alan Davis. And that, to me, is my favorite Alan Moore work. The whole Jaspers, Creature of the Fury, and the whole Warp thing, it just blew my mind.
That was some of Alan Davis's first professional work, too, wasn't it?
I think that was his first.
Yeah.
It started out, Alan Moore wasn't the original writer. I think it was Dave Thorpe.
Chris Claremont actually created Captain Britain.
Yeah, with Herb Trimpe. But, anyway, when Alan Davis came on, that's when they redid Captain Britain into the cavalry uniform, everybody knows. And I think Dave Thorpe was the one that wrote it. And then Alan Moore came on right after that. But that's my favorite work he did. But I'd have to say Alan Moore is my favorite writer, per se.
I think that's the general consensus. It's kind of hard not to say that, I guess. And it's almost a cop-out because he's almost too good for the medium,
But everything he does, like, you know, the From Hell work, it's completely different from anything else. And even From Hell, I'm sitting there thinking, I never would have thought of that. And I guess that's what gets me, is everything, even when he interviews, if you listen to him on podcast, you have certain creators come on, and basically they have a whole thing they say, and oh, that's pretty good. And then they go to another podcast, and it's almost word for word the same thing.
It's like an identical interview.
Right. Which, you know, I mean, you tend to do that.
We'll do that for the next episode. Just say the exact same stuff.
That's the fear. But when Alan Moore, I've heard him on several, and every one is completely different. He's always very interesting. He's always well-spoken, you know, and he thinks about a lot of things. But every time he does a story, it's always, you know, just unique. It's easy to read, but it's like you mentioned earlier, if you really think about it, it really wraps your head around, you know.
Yeah, he's a very thought-provoking writer. I mean, he's not one of those guys that just walks in and collects his check and walks away. You know, he leaves a mark on the things he does.
Yeah, absolutely. He does.
And he plays, like you mentioned about The Watchmen, he plays a lot with the comics medium. He does things that are unique for comics, the storytelling and the timing and everything like that. And so that's why I've always liked him. Again, I still prefer artist-writer teams or an artist-writer one person. But, yeah, Alan Moore is the one that stands out for me.
Very nice. All right, well, we're going to take a quick music break. This is a local band. Once again, they're called Real Eyes. And this is a live recording of a song called Better Off. And then right after the music break, we'll continue with the Alan Moore Appreciation Podcast. Thank you.
Seems like I've heard that guitar before.
Yeah, I seem to know a couple of those guys. They seem familiar. I don't know why.
Yeah, that was me. I'm the guitarist.
Nothing like shameless self-promotion.
Well, I think that's why I think you heard somebody in the crowd go, Dallas!
What was the name of that band again?
Real Eyes. Yeah, it's an old
clever
band of mine. Thanks.
Clever.
Thank you. All right, back to the... Back to the discussions that we were having, we were talking about favorite writers, and Don, you just finished. I think we had another long dissertation on Alan Moore's work. is there anything else you want to add there? Any other writers you particularly are fond of?
Well, there's a bunch, but I mean, again, it's always a combination. But I'd say Carl Barks, Gilbert Hernandez, those are the two that always enjoyed the most. I like the combination. But anyway, I've had my say. And Dallas, what is your favorite writer?
Yes. All right. Wait, I have notes. I have notes. I'm pretty much reading off paper here. All right. I got a good big list of them, just like Ron did. But I got to say my honorable mention would go to Kurt Busiek and Grant Morrison because they're always turning out just really quality work. I mean, some of Busiek's highlights are the Astro City. I don't know if either of you have read Astro City.
I've read some of it.
And Morrison's Invisibles, which is fantastic books.
Oh, yeah.
Couple others that I really like, David Latham and Peter Bagg. They have, speaking of characterization and growth, they're great on Latham did Stray Bullets, Peter Bagg did Hate. And I mean, Hate especially was following like these same characters over the years and watched them get older and watched them get jobs. And it was really neat to see that kind of thing. And of course, we were talking about this off-air not long ago, but David Mazzucchelli, he's an artist, but out of nowhere he had released Asterio's Polyp couple years ago, and that just blew my mind, his writing style.
Yeah.
And, all right, no surprise, but Alan Moore, I wasn't going to bring it up, because you guys had, but...
Do you think he's like Beetlejuice? If we say his name enough times, he'll show up?
Or Candyman. It's more like Candyman. A little different spin, and I'll be short on this. For me, his greatest accomplishment was Promethea, because it was definitely one of the most entertaining, thorough, and insightful comics that I've had the pleasure of reading. It's he made me care about the characters, which he does in all his books. But for me, that was a great different twist on an old fable, you could say, or an old legend. Okay, all right. My top two would have to be, here we go, drum roll, Don. Chris Claremont, of course.
Oh, yeah. Shock. We're all falling out of our chairs.
I know.
Shock. Really? Really?
All right. Specifically, Don earlier was talking about his Marvel team-up work. Me would have to be a staggering 16-year run on Uncanny X-Men from 1975 to 1991. All right. Besides our show, where I gush about him, he gets a lot of hate on the internet for a lot of things. I mean, people make fun of his dialogue, which is kind of, people say it's out of date, kind of verbose, really boastful. And yeah, it can be over the top, but it's very subtle and specific places too, and that's what I really loved about his work, is he was good at knowing when to hold back for dramatic effect. And that's kind of what he brought to the table, is drama. In all the years that X-Men was under his pen, it was just a really long soap opera, you know? And he gave all his characters personality. They had a voice, and that voice stayed consistent from issue to issue. And you didn't see that a lot in mainstream. I mean, they stayed consistent, and you saw characters like Storm change. She grew over the years. I mean, we were just talking about this with other books, but in an X-Men book, in a Marvel book, that usually didn't happen because things would go back to the status quo.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you mention that. I think Storm offhand is one of the few characters in X-Men that you can actually see change with.
You can track her progress.
Yeah, you just look at her outfits even, and you know what timeline it was when just looking at a picture of her.
Yeah.
Where most of the other characters, they really didn't have that, especially Wolverine. I mean, he's kind of always been the same.
Right, and I mean, the only thing you see from Wolverine, really, besides Claremont's personality by Claremont changing, is his changing costume, and the main reasons for that, like when Jim Lee jumped on the book, he just felt like drawing the old blue and yellow Wolverine costume, so he changed the costume, but there wasn't really a story behind it, you know?
Yeah, but with Storm, there was reasoning behind her change of costume.
Exactly. You know, she was affected by the outside world.
I think Storm probably, of all X-Men characters, might have the most depth, other than, well, Cyclops.
Yeah, hey, that's a good point, too. Cyclops, I mean, under Chris Claremont's pen, he was amazing. Yeah. He changed. He started as kind of a bashful guy in the Lee and Kirby days. He became this strong, sturdy leader, and he was a great fighter, and you saw him turn into this complete arsehole. By the time the 200s came around, he had married Madeline Pryor. He ended up leaving his wife and his child and running off to Jean Grey, and he just completely became this jerk, kind of out of left field. You didn't expect it to happen. And I don't know how much of that was editorially mandated, because at the time, I think they were forming a book called X-Factor, where Cyclops and Jean Grey had to be together. But nonetheless, you saw this great guy that you had been watching over the years grow as a leader and suddenly just have a downward spiral as a human being.
Well, that was something that Chris Claremont used to write that I liked. Was he was, you know, working as the leader of X-Men, but at one point Professor X was taken over again, and he was complaining because Wolverine wouldn't, you know, cooperate with the rest of the team.
Rook's like the Wolverine of the podcast. He's got adamantium claws.
Well, Professor X was getting kind of heavy-handed with it. And I remember that was something Cyclops was always talking about, was they're different than the old X-Men. You know, it's just, you can't do it that way. And I remember Professor X was saying, "That's your shortcoming, Scott. I'll fix it." And that's what I always liked. Even though he was a strong leader, he was still human. You know, he had his shortcomings and doubts and stuff like that, but he was always a strong character. I stopped reading it. Once in a while I'd pick up an issue in the 80s, but not too much. And I was always surprised when, I guess it's when Jim Lee came on, and all of a sudden he started looking more like a warrior. He wasn't the Scott Summers that I knew.
A lot of pockets and pouches everywhere.
Yeah, those shoulder belts and stuff, you know. And I mean, if people like that, that's fine. I understand characters change over time, but to me, he looked like a completely different character, you know. So
he had become pretty stagnant, too, throughout the 90s. And I know Joss Whedon had a run in Astonishing X-Men a few years back that really brought Cyclops to the forefront. And he developed more as a character in those few issues than he had in, like, the past decade. So that was neat to see.
Yeah. I think it's interesting to see some of the things that they've done with all the X-Men characters over the years, how some remain timelessly young and others evolve, you know, and everybody has their own little favorites amongst the X-Men, of course.
Yeah.
Who's your favorite?
My favorite out of, well...
Put you on the spot.
Not an X-Men character, actually, but he is in the X-Universe, would be Cannonball.
Oh, okay.
There's actually
unsung hero.
Well, it's funny because this just came to mind as we're talking about Cyclops evolving and changing. Cannonball really did a lot of that in the X-Force series. There's an amazing scene amazing scene between him and Professor X, where, of course, if anybody remembers the old X-Force series, Cannonball, Cable was running the show, and something had happened. I don't remember if he went back to the future, or if he had died, or what. But Cannonball was running the team, and they ended up at the mansion, and Xavier was scolding Cannonball for their heavy-handedness and things like that. And there was this whole thing between him and Xavier, and Cannonball. Cannonball was talking about how the closed fist can be used to harm, and then he opens his hand, and you see a mouse in it, and he goes, "But it can also be used to help as well." And it was the whole open hand versus the closed fist methods.
Right.
And Cannonball actually cocked back and went to slap Xavier, stating that the open hand can be used to harm as well. Just like the closed fist can be used to harm and other times to help or something to that effect. I'm going to have to go back and find that issue now.
You know, that's a good analogy.
Is that Claremont?
No.
I don't know
Post
who wrote that, honestly. I can't even think of what issue it was.
Maybe Fabian Nicieza? Maybe.
Might have been.
Either way, that was, I agree, a good character moment and a great analogy overall to be used. And it's nice that Cannonball had a strong voice like that because he's been around in the Marvel Universe since the early 80s.
Well, and especially against Xavier, of all people.
Right.
You know, this almost godlike figure in the X-Men universe to be knocked down a peg by this character that's basically, you know, just kind of there. You know, nobody really puts much stock into Cannonball. And for him to have that moment with Xavier where, you know, it was very much a, he's in charge, I'm in charge, kiss my ass kind of moment with Cannonball. Mm. So, yeah, I really like Cannonball a lot.
Yeah, I can tell.
Yeah, I never heard of that. I was one of those that dismissed him as well. This is the first ever thought of that. That's pretty good.
Yeah, well, in that whole entire X-Force series, Cable was really grooming Cannonball to run the team overall, and that was like his big step-up moment.
That was a big step for Sam because in the New Mutants, he was such a... He had always tried to be a leader, but he was kind of just like a hillbilly. That's kind of how they showed him as.
Him and his whole family are a bunch of damn hayseeds. You know?
Yeah.
I mean,
no offense to any hayseeds out there.
Yeah, no offense to any hayseeds out there, but I mean, you know, they always picture them as these kind of yokel, doofy characters. But in reality, I mean, his whole family is some very powerful characters in the Marvel Universe. You know, and you take a look at Skin, his sister, with
Generation X. No, it's Husk, right?
Oh, no, it is. Wait, wasn't she called Skin in 1.2? Skin? Or?
Oh, maybe she
No, I think you're right. Husk, yeah. Yeah, because like husking corn. I think that's Husk.
And there you go, that's an analogy.
This is a person related to Cannonball?
It's his sister.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He's got like 13 brothers and sisters or something outrageous.
I knew
he
had a lot of brothers and sisters because when the New Mutants started in that graphic novel, he mentioned them. But I didn't know that there were other mutants as well.
Actually, I think quite a few of his brothers and sisters ended up with
they show
the X-Gene.
They show up throughout the years. That's right.
Yeah, they kind of pop up at random points.
That's kind of like you can tell writers kind of digging back and trying to find history and seeing that, oh, look, Sam Guthrie, Cannonball's got a bunch of brothers and sisters. Let's bring some of them into the story.
Yeah. But Husk was a cool character, too, you know, with the whole shedding the skin to whatever would be underneath. I can't remember actually ever reading that she had control of it, though. She did in the Age of Apocalypse series, but I don't think in the regular universe that she ever did.
It's funny, I always thought, because of her disposition, to me she always seemed a much more interesting character than Cannonball, only because I had read more of her stuff, probably.
She was kind of one of those throwaway characters, one of those ones that I always expected them to kill off.
Uh-huh. They probably did eventually. I think
they probably
a lot
did.
Of those
I
characters.
Don't know. It's been so long since I've really dived into the X-Men universe. So.
Yeah. Do you have any favorites, Don?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that the whole time you said it. I liked them all. I liked the original new X-Men. You know, Wolverine, Storm, Nightcrawler.
Banshee.
Yeah, Banshee. I even liked it when Angel came back in that time. I mean, I always loved them. But just trying to find a favorite, I guess Storm would be my favorite. But, I mean, like I said, I loved them all. I loved Wolverine, his old backstory. I couldn't find really a favorite. I guess it had to be Storm, maybe Phoenix. I like the original Phoenix. I didn't like how they keep bringing her back all the time.
Yeah.
But I thought that was, he was a neat character. I thought it was a neat storyline. And when she died, I just thought that was really something else.
Yeah, so it was a very unique touch.
Yeah, I'll say Phoenix was my favorite.
That's your final answer?
That's my final answer.
Okay.
Quick side thought on that. You mentioned Angel. What do you like better, Angel or Archangel?
I don't like either, but I'd go with Angel because the stories that I've read with Angel are more satisfying, and I've read most of the old Roy Thomas and Stan Lee and even the Neil Adams penciled original X-Men, and I always thought Angel was a pretty cool dude.
Yeah. See, I'm going purely by aesthetics alone as far as character design. I think Angel with the feathered wings is much cooler than the metal wings.
Yeah.
Well, Archangel's kind of a product of his time, too, I would say. A lot of characters during the 90s were, they're going for that edgy, kind of, at the time, modern look, and to draw in kids and new readers and what have you, and I think that was one of the reasons they did the whole, let's get a darker, cooler, you know, air quotes, looking Angel, and call him Archangel, and that's probably one of the reasons, and yeah, he never jived with me, like a lot of the characters at that time never did.
I couldn't tell you. I never read them. I've seen it. I asked the guy I work with what happened. That happened in the late 80s when he turned into Archangel.
Thanks, probably.
Yeah, because he was actually one of the four horsemen of Apocalypse. He was Death.
Oh, was he?
Apocalypse did
that.
That's
right, Apocalypse. That was Louis Simonson, I think. Probably
it was Walt Louis Simonson. I did hear Walt Simonson in an interview one time saying that the original X-Men, they just felt they were some of them were a little weak in the power department, according to the rest of the Marvel universe. So they were going to bump him up. But, again, I never read him. I never liked how he looked. You know, I think I've heard Walt Simonson say that, you know, he loved the Archangel look and really proud of it. It's pretty neat. But, yeah, I knew Angel. That's the one I liked. And really, it's just a guy with wings that could fly around. I mean,
interestingly enough, they expanded on him later on. They started talking more about his body strength in one issue, where he went to hit he did hit someone, and he absolutely just crushed him. And he makes the comment about, "Well, have you ever seen a bird take off? Do you know how much power it takes, how much muscle it takes to lift yourself?" He goes, yeah, now think about that with a human size. Huh. So they started kind of explaining some things with him, and he's apparently very strong now as well. So
that was something they kept bringing up all the time when Claremont, Byrne, and Austin did the X-Men, was they kept referring back to the original, you know, five X-Men. The team was a cohesive team that worked together, was well-trained. And that the new X-Men were all individuals. They were all basically characters on their own, by themselves, you know, with superpowers, and they put them together as a team, especially Wolverine. And that was something Cyclops was always saying. I don't know if they're ever going to be as cohesive as the old X-Men. You're always hearing, all the way through that series, you know, the original five X-Men were a cohesive unit, and they worked together. So it never really made sense to me when they were saying the original X-Men weren't really, you know, up in the power department, they beefed them up some because they were a cohesive unit that worked so well together.
Yeah, they were a tactical team. I mean, they trained together to do the missions. Where the new X-Men, of course, to most people now, they're not the new X-Men.
Yeah, once again, air quotes because that's what they were known as. The all new, all different.
They were known as the new X-Men then. You know, they were kind of they were thrown together, a mishmash group, last ditch effort to save the X-Men.
And they were a lot older, so they were more...
Well, they were established, they were established people, established mutants. That's one of my favorite things in the Byrne and Claremont and Austin run. Was all through that series, they kept bringing up, they'll never be as cohesive. And, you know, it'd be mentioned once in a while. And then after Phoenix died, and Kitty Pryde joined the team. They never made a big thing about it, but it showed them... I guess Professor X was out, and Storm was the leader, and they had Kitty go through the danger room. And it showed Storm at the microphone telling her what to do, and she went through it. And it was a cakewalk, you know, nothing that happened ever bothered her. She just went all the way through it. And then it was just one panel of Storm, Wolverine, Colossus, Nightcrawler. And they're all just together at the console. I remember Wolverine's, he's laughing his head off, saying, you know, this kills me. Charlie spent, you know, a week trying to prepare this danger room, and she walked through like it was nothing. But the rest of them are amused. You know, Storm was sitting there. She was, like, kind of relaxed and kind of, like, relieved and happy. But in that one panel, it showed that they were a cohesive unit.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't sit there and spell it out and all these dialogue or anything.
They had become
it.
A family because of everything they had gone through.
And you could read it and see that, you know, after all the experiences they went through, they were all of a sudden a team, a cohesive team. And it was things like that that those guys did together that it just amazed me. And, like, even though there was no words in it, you could tell Chris Claremont set that thing up, and then, you know, it was just fantastic. And then after that, now, after the team split up, I could just imagine Chris Claremont writing, like, four paragraphs for that one panel, setting it all up. So, you know, anyway, that's one of my favorite times in the series.
Well, yeah, speaking of kitties, she would have to be my favorite X-Man. She's kind of a POV character, especially for me. It's neat. She was a young character coming into the X-Men, and quite often you saw things through her eyes. And she, just watching her grow with the X-Men and become a member of the team and prove herself constantly to everyone, and she was always such a strong-willed person, and it was just neat. I just really enjoyed all the stories with her, just watching her grow. And Joss Whedon even touched on that quite a bit in his Astonishing X-Men run, because he was such a huge fan of her, and the majority of that book was from Kitty's perspective. But, yeah.
You mentioned that before. You know, I always appreciated it. When I saw Kitty, I liked her when they first introduced her. And it seems to me like, and of course I didn't read it regularly, once in a while I'd pick something up, but it seemed like they never could figure out exactly what to do with her, and they were always changing around some. And that was always my point of view on it, was like, well, she was a neat character, but... And
yeah,
then
it was kind of like a lost direction. It's like, hey, I got a great idea for a character. Oh, crap, now what do we do with her?
Well, yeah, and they kept making her a warrior and stuff. That's why I always saw her as that awkward 12-year-old girl that joined the team. And, I mean, you know, in Excalibur, I thought she was a good character.
She was great in Excalibur, yeah. She was kind of the a computer whiz, kind of a nerdy
right.
person. But, I mean, she was just a great addition.
But
she was
never,
the heart and soul of
yeah,
the team.
She was a neat character, but I just always looked at her as kind of awkward, like they weren't really sure what to do, and they were always shoehorning her in into something else.
But with her, you also got that great relationship between her and Colossus. I mean, that was...
Yeah.
That was, I mean...
Oh, that was great. Speaking of soap opera, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, X-Men has always been known to have great romance underneath their storylines, you know, between Scott and Jean.
Now Scott and Emma.
Yeah, now Scott and Emma, you know, who's next for Scotty boy here. But, you know...
Hey, that's a great team-up, though. Emma's such a strong character.
Yeah, there's still...
But I digress.
Yeah, I still don't like her. But, you know... Kitty and Colossus, I mean, that was like the new generation, Jean and Scott.
Yeah, they were like the sweethearts of the X-Men.
Yeah, and I think that's why that one panel in the Ultimate X-Men was so devastating to a lot of readers, where they got to the end of that book and Colossus goes, "I'm gay." And people went,
"What?
What?
Colossus was gay?" Yeah, in the Ultimate Universe, Colossus was
Who wrote
gay.
That? Bendis?
Oh.
I do not
Miller?
Remember who wrote it.
Millar, whatever.
I just remember the backlash from people when they read it. Were like, "Oh, screw this! I'm not reading this." You know, because they're expecting the romance between Colossus and
yeah.
Kitty.
Right.
Well, it's Ultimates Universe.
Anything goes.
In the Ultimates Universe, anything can happen.
Yeah.
You know?
Speaking of the coming out thing, didn't Peter David made Richter gay? Year or two back, out of nowhere, and he's a mainstay character that's been around since at least the late '80s, I think.
What is
yeah,
he?
Yeah, Richter.
Richter.
Richter's
he was
yeah.
a member of New Mutants.
Yeah. Well, you know that a lot of that also shows the evolution. That's needed for these storylines, especially when you're talking about something like the X-Men, where they've always approached the issues of civil rights, you know, and they've always talked about the rights of mutants, you know.
That's always the backbone of the story.
So it's proper that they start making these characters have alternate lifestyles outside of the normal, mundane, you know, straight life.
I completely agree with you.
They need to have gay, lesbian, transgender characters. They really do. Otherwise, they're just hypocrites, really. You know, otherwise you're talking about a book that wants to talk about civil rights but doesn't actually do anything.
Well, that's the weight of the writer's shoulders. I mean, they have to uphold that
standard.
Yeah, that standard that has come to be known. And as our own culture changes, then, you know, the culture of the mutants has to change too.
Well, yeah, I agree with all that. I think in Alpha Flight, North Star, wasn't he supposed to be?
He was. That was once again, like, that was kind of retcon, like I'm sure the Richter thing was, though. That was years after the character was created that he turned out to be gay.
Well, yeah.
Which is fine. I think it's a good idea. But, yeah, I don't think initially he was meant to be back in the 80s.
Yeah, well, when he appeared in the X-Men, when they showed it, you know, there was the ski champion, and they had all these ladies around, and he was signing autographs. But I remember in Alpha Flight, there was the one, not trying to seem thick, but his twin sister came to see him, and they met this professor. And she said, you knew him when he was at university. And the professor kept saying, oh, yes, he's a unique young man with special talents. And that was it. And I thought, okay, well, you know.
What kind of special talents?
Yeah, well, this is back in, like, 83. This was in 1983. And then it was years and years later when I was reading an interview with John Byrne and somebody said, and you may, you know, North Star was the first gay character. What? And then I realized back then the professor was talking about something different than what I was thinking. So he was setting it up back in the beginning. But I could see that. I mean, you know, but Colossus, I mean, like I said, I read them up to the 1981 or so. But I never read anything where it made it sound like, you know, he was even remotely.
Well, like I said, though, this was the Ultimates universe.
Okay,
this
well,
wasn't the regular storylines. This is the alternate universe that Marvel set up. That was supposed to be, I think they originally thought it to be more for the kids, for new readers.
Yeah, that's
and
what it was
Ultimates
meant to be.
Ultimates really kind of ended up going the other way and ended up really more for the adult readers, which I think is great. I think that's what's necessary. To get me back to Marvel would really need a universe like that where characters age, evolve, change.
Well, you know, if any of the X-Men characters are gay, I'd say it's got to be Iceman. See how, see how much of a snappy dresser that dude is?
Oh, his favorite place is Harris Village, so yeah.
There you go.
Oh,
there you go, that's right.
Nice.
Little smiling Stanley. All right,
never mind.
Oh, I have one more favorite writer, and this has been quite Marvel-centric this episode, so I kind of want to switch gears a little bit, and I'm sure this will be short because I don't know if you guys would agree with me at all or not. But My very favorite number one writer would have to be Dave Sim for his work on Cerebus, which is my very favorite comic book. Dave Sim's a Kitchener, Ontario resident, so he's Canadian. And all Canadian jokes aside, he's a badass.
Hey.
Throughout his 26-year, 300-issue run, he covered and mastered all sorts of different genres, including starting off with adventuring. Cerebus originally was kind of a Conan the Barbarian ripoff, kind of a joke. It turned into political and religious drama. And, I mean, being the only writer, Dave was able to speed up and slow down the narrative when necessary. And I think one of his greatest strengths would be his pacing, his timing. You could have a year's worth of issues go along and only one or two minimal things that would happen that would account up to like a day or two in the life of Cerebus. And then you can have the next issue suddenly speed up and it could be a year's worth of things going on. And it was amazing what he did with the comic book medium. One of the great things also that that Dave Sim was able to do, since he was a self-publisher, he was able to stay in direct contact with his fan base. And he did this in a letters column in every issue, which you had in a lot of old books, especially the big two, the DC and Marvel. But, I mean, the fights and the drama that ensued in the letters column was just as exciting as the comic book itself. Like, he was picking fights with every reader, and there was so much going on.
Now, when did the Cerebus character first start? Like, what year was that?
It was, Cerebus, I think, had appeared in the mid-70s in a couple different issues, and initially he was going to be like a little logo for just a magazine or a company. But the very first issue of Cerebus was, I think, 1977. And Sim was really young. And throughout his career, I mean, people change. And so Sim's voice as a writer changed drastically between
so his character changed as well.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I know a lot of people didn't always agree with Sim, but that's neither here nor there as far as being a writer. freaking
tremendous. Well, I think
Cerebus
also says a lot for creator-controlled books, too.
Yeah.
You know, being that he did self-publish the book, it was completely under his control to do what he pleased with the book. And look how successful it is.
And he was a huge promoter of that, Sim was.
Yeah, definitely. An enormously successful book.
Absolutely, and that's one of his strengths as a writer, as a creator, was being able to maintain the success of a book that he was publishing by himself. I mean, that's pretty impressive.
And it was monthly, too, right?
Yeah, it was monthly. I mean, he was churning out, him and his background artist, Gerhard, were churning out a 20-page book every single month, just the two of them, drawing it, writing it, inking it, everything, lettering it. I could go into his skills as a letterer.
Is Gerhard, right, was the background artist. What year did he come
out? He started around the Church and State era, which is one of my favorites, was Church and State. I don't know when that was. That must have been the mid-80s, I'm guessing.
Yeah, because I used to find Cerebus. I was surprised. I was in it was a small store, and the guy basically, he was into war memorabilia. He sold those little lead figures of the war, British soldiers and stuff. And he had a little cabinet, and he sold ElfQuest, he sold Cerebus, and a couple of other magazines. I think he had Heavy Metal. And he said the only reason he did that was nobody had Cerebus, and he wanted to read it. And so I'd picked up some of the old issues, and I always liked it. I thought it was pretty neat. I remember people would talk about it in trade publications, and they said that Dave and Denny Sim proved that you could do a monthly comic, self-publish it, and still make a living at it.
That's right.
And I was surprised at how much the character changed over the years. But I always loved it. I thought it was a fun book. I always liked how he'd rip. He had a Moon Knight parody, which I thought was genius. And when I was in college, I was showing this to some of my friends, going over panel by panel. I was the guy like, yeah, you see this? And look at what he does now. Yeah, isn't this cool? You know, I was just constantly going on doing that.
Well, that was a kind of a cool character, too. That was Dave's commentary on the industry, was that character called the Roach.
Yeah.
And every few years, that character, the Roach, would parody a famous character, like you said, Moon Knight. So
right.
The Roach was called Moon Roach at one time.
Well, and he had one of my friends made a comment that how he was inking him, it had that Neil Adams feel to it, you know.
Right.
You could see his toes through the boot and stuff when he was jumping. And I really enjoyed it. And I guess this is the high society, you know, time.
Yeah.
And I was buying these issues and always enjoying it. And I bought one issue, and I'm not trying to seem like I'm an idiot. I was so excited. I got home. I started reading it. And I said, man, this guy, look how he's drawing this. It had the two bodyguards with him. He's going through a crowd. They're looking in each direction. I said, look how much he's thinking of this stuff. This guy's like a genius. Why doesn't more people read this book? And then a few pages into it, I'm like, oh, God, when does this stop? And I just stopped reading the book. It just got so tedious.
That's a good word for it, too, because like I was saying before, he slows down parts of the story sometimes. And it can be really tedious, and it can turn off a lot of people.
Oh,
you know, it really can, but I mean, it was pure genius, the things he did.
This same friend of mine that I'd seen in college and I was showing him the books, he pointed it out, and I said, yeah, I don't read it. I don't like it anymore. He goes, what are you talking about? Just a few months ago, you were talking about how much you loved it and how incredible it was. I said, yeah, well, you know.
Well, I think that's with any comic book, though, really. I mean, anything that you read is eventually going to get to the, I'm done with this point. And I mean, you know, every issue can't be gold.
No, yeah. I agree, and that's probably, he did lose quite a bit of readers over different areas of his career, but I mean, a lot of it, yeah, like you're saying, it can't be good every issue. People, I mean, if you're reading it on a monthly basis, you might be waiting 6-7 months, you might be reading 6 or 7 issues before something really happens that you enjoy.
Right.
There's an issue where he's just probably sleeping and peeing, the whole issue, you know, that's a month's worth of comic, and you're not going to find out what happens after that until the next month.
Yeah, well, and go back to Kirkman for a minute here. You know, there's another writer that does that. I mean, you could go several months just seeing dialogue between the survivors. That's it. And never have any action, never have anything, you know, no cars exploding or, you know, nothing like that. No zombies attacking. It's just, you know, common everyday occurrence kind of things, you know.
I think that's the magic of being able to work on a creator-owned property. You have the luxury of doing what you want. You don't have a deadline. You don't have a certain quota or something you have to meet because it's a franchise or it's someone else's property.
The only one to make happy is yourself.
Right.
And if you make your readers happy along the way, hey, bonus points.
Exactly. And then you can make a living out of it, which is fantastic.
Well, you know, the Cerebus stuff, I see that once in a while. I pick up an issue here and there. I was always shocked at just how, especially when Gerhard joined, at just how much it visually appealing.
The detail was amazing. The world became so realistic. I mean, it was believable.
Well, and there was times where I'd buy an issue and I'd say, man, why did I ever stop getting this? And I'd start, you know, trying to find others. But again, I would just get tired of it real quick.
Well, I got a huge pile of all the phone books there.
There's a giant pile of Cerebus books over
here.
Well,
you know, on the phone books, I'm going to say, I've said this to Dallas before, I think those are genius, because if you decide you like Cerebus and you pick one of those up, yeah, that's a thick read. It's a nice-looking package. It's a lot to read, and if you like it, all the phone books are accessible.
Yeah,
you got a lot of reading.
The phone books are the collected editions of all the Cerebus books. You could have a 20 or 30 issue run of Cerebus inside one of the phone books, and I mean, that's a lot of content. It's really dense. There's a lot to read there.
And if you're listening to the show and you're born after 94, the phone company used to put together this really thick book on newsprint that had everybody's phone number in it.
Even yours.
And it even had a yellow pages. There was usually, in bigger cities, a separate page just this thick. And they used to have muscle men take these phone books and rip them in half.
I know, mind-blowing, isn't it?
Yeah.
it's kind of funny to think that they still deliver phone books.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Surprised we still get the paper, like the local paper here.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of people still read the paper, you know. And I'll tell you...
Oh, I'm not saying they shouldn't.
The world changed, but you know, whenever I went to another town, this is like when I was in the Navy, and when I got out of the Navy and I went around with no direction. Anytime I got into a new town, the first thing I do was find a convenience store or a grocery store where there was a payphone. Everybody had payphones, every lobby, everywhere. It's different now. But they always had the phone books hanging on these little chains, you know, in a little plastic case.
Yeah.
I'd pull it out. The first thing I did, look under used books, you know, used and rare books, and I'd find a comic store. And that's how I always found them. And then, I guess it was in the late 90s, I was in some town in the Southwest. I see payphones and no phone book. And then somebody said, well, they're stealing them. What? So the phone company stopped putting them out. Well, how do you find anything if you don't live here? This, again, is before the internet really picked up.
Yeah.
But, you know, now it's just a complete antique. But, I mean, not that long ago, that was something you needed. And when you moved to a new town, you needed the phone book to find where anything was. You always looked it up.
Yeah, that's how you get a hold of a local store or, you know, any place you needed to.
You know, this kind of brings me to a topic that I always like to talk to people about is digital versus paper with comics. I mean, I really have never met anybody that collects digital comics, you know, that can say I'm a digital comic reader, you know.
I do believe in the next few years, though, there will be a time when people are doing that.
I believe so, too, but I really don't foresee that the comic book itself will ever go away.
I hope
so. There are people that just, they need to have that physical item in their hands.
Mm-hmm. It's that collector mentality, I think.
Yeah. Well, you know, as tech-savvy as I am, like to pretend I am.
You are.
I really don't ever see myself moving away from the paper comic. I like to go to the comic book shop, discuss the books, hang out with the guys, you know, and talk about what's going on.
Right.
I don't think I could ever be a mail order subscription comic guy or, you know, just reading digital online.
Right. So. Half the experience, I know, at least for you and for a lot of people, is the interaction with other people at the comic shop. You enjoy going to Yancey Street all the time.
Yeah, Yancey.
Which is great, great local store, right? Yancey Street Comics?
Yep, Yancey Street Comics, by the way, I do actually have the right information now for the signing.
Oh, we might have brought this up last episode. Yeah,
yeah,
they're having a signing, right?
I was a little remiss here. Sergio Carella... Cariello will be in the store August 13th from 12 to 2. He's going to be signing issues of Superman number 1. And also along with him, Chuck Dixon's going to be there too.
Yeah, baby.
So you guys all go check him out. You can find him at yanceystreetcomics.com. And the actual store address is 9409 U.S. Highway 19 in Port Richey, Florida, 34668. And go in there, tell them that Two Dimensions sent you.
Yeah, please.
No, wait a minute. I thought Yancey Street was in Manhattan.
Yeah, and they always give the thing a bunch of shit.
Yeah. There's all kinds of guys running around there with little green cut-off jean jackets, too.
I have to say, though, Don said it last episode, best comic book store name ever.
Oh. Woohoo! Oh,
Yancey Street Comics. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Well, I think we should probably wrap it up, guys. We're getting around that time. We have plenty to talk about. But
before we finish, I do want to say one thing. Rook had mentioned he never knew anybody that read the digital comics. I do. There's one person I work with, James. It's a shout-out to you.
James.
I always see James on the computer, always reading page after page of electronic comics. I think that's his preferred way. Now, there's times he's lent me a couple of the books he had. He buys them at, you know, stores. He buys them online. But it seems to me his preferred way, which bewilders me because I couldn't stand it, he sits there and goes page after page on the computer. And I think that's what he prefers. On Facebook, Paul Grist had posted something years ago that he just read America's going to spend I don't know how many millions of dollars on intangible goods. And he said it bewilders him. Well, and I posted that it bewilders me too, but I see people doing it. Songs on iTunes, stuff like that. And I mentioned at one point, I think it's my age, I like to buy the CD. I don't like to go on iTunes to buy it, even though I have an iPod. Another guy came up, a much younger guy, and he was talking about everything he buys is electronically. His comic books, his this is before the iPad came out, his music, his movies, everything he gets electronically. And then he started complaining about the movie theater. And I was always bringing up the movie theater. I don't think you're really buying anything. You're buying the experience. It's a big screen in the audience, you know, with a bunch of people. And I remember the guy was coming up talking about he's always with a bunch of twits in the theater disturbing the movie and making noise and pestering him, which I understand, too. And, again, part of that maybe is the age. I like to go around other people. Just like you mentioned a comic shop, it's fun to go and talk to the guys at the comic. Even if you don't talk, even hearing other guys talking about it. But yet, I do know one human being that reads his comics on the computer. So
that's a good point, too. And I mean, and he's a newer comic book reader, per se. I mean, he reads a lot of the more recent stuff, and he hasn't been reading since the 70s or 80s, I think. And so he's adjusted really quickly and easily, and I think that's going to happen to a lot of young kids. They're going to grow up with digital comics. That's going to be their avenue, just like they're growing up with digital music.
But I do think
we're all going to be a bunch of crotchety old men sitting there in our wheelchairs and deathbeds with physical comics still in our hands.
Exactly.
Yeah, this is the way you really read.
And at least we'll have full houses, though. They'll have big empty houses with nothing.
Yes,
well,
exactly.
Except a computer.
But yeah, at the same time, he does buy. He lent me it was an X-Men book. It was Peter Milligan wrote it. It was about
writer.
It wasn't X-Men. It was
Ecstatics.
No, it was Wolverine, Hulk, Psylocke. It was five different characters, but they were in medieval Japan. And I wasn't really interested. He lent it to me. I read one story. I said, man, this is really something. So he let me keep it till I read all five. It was really good. It was five different artists. But I think he had read that online and liked it and wanted a copy of it.
Mm. That's a good thing if people do that.
Well, Neil Gaiman, it's on boingboing.com. There's a video, and he's talking about it. I guess in the beginning, he would get really upset when people would come up and say, I read your book online for free. And I think he was really down on it and was always going for creators' rights and, you know, electronic rights and stuff like that. And on it's a brief interview. If you go to boingboing.com, look him up. But he talks about that. He said he started finding it.
Shameless plug.
But, he was talking about, he found that his sales were rising on these books these people were getting, downloading for free. And he said he started realizing it was introducing him to another audience, and if they liked the story enough, they wanted a copy of it for good. Think about all the people that buy all those Seinfeld box sets on DVD. You can watch it, you know, they show it like, what, four or five times a day on TV, and yet I have all of them, you know.
Yeah, you do.
You know, there are certain things you like a lot, movies. You know, you can watch them on TV, but, you know, you still buy the DVDs. So, that's one thing I've always wondered about with electronic comics. They're kind of expensive, buying them online electronically.
Yeah, for an intangible good, yeah, I would never spend that kind of money.
Even 99 cents, what they're talking about, it needs to go down to 99 cents. To me, that's still too much. And, you know, I've heard the argument, you know, with iTunes, and people talk about it. you can buy a song for 99 cents, but that's a complete song that's yours and you listen to all the time. Whereas a comic book, how many times is it a 20-page story that's in depth and it's a full story? It's usually a small fragment of an entire story.
And you're not going to read it every single day, whereas Absolutely. You might listen to a song every day.
So,
yeah, exactly.
You know, that's what I always thought about was, I know in Japan, I've always read about in the 70s, those books like Shonen Jump, again, they're phone books. They're done on cheap paper. They're basically supposed to be disposable like American comic books, even though they're thick.
Oh, yeah, my kid has tons of those.
Right. Well, see, that was a new thing when I read about in the 80s. I never heard of it. But they said that actually the publishers are barely breaking even or even losing money on those monthly books that they put out. And they say where they make the money up is the series that do really well, they put together in basically the graphic novel format, you know, they're thick and on the nice paper, and the people buy those, and that's where the publishers get their books. And that's where it gets their money. And that's the thing, they can really afford to take a chance on some books, you know, stories that, you know, may not do so well, but they can, you know, see if it sticks to the wall. And that's what I always wonder about with electronic comics, is they could just offer them for a small fraction of a price or nothing. Which I know sounds insane, and I'm not publishing books, but if people like it enough, they can get a copy of their own.
Well, I've made the comment before with digital comics that I thought the idea of, you know, after you buy the physical book, being able to somehow punch in your UPC code,
yes.
Or, I mean, look at it now with, like, take for example, barcode scanners on phones. You know, be able to scan in and state that you have purchased it, because we all know that phones have GPSs, so the program could register that you are at your home, you aren't at a store scanning random barcodes.
Good call.
Right.
And then you'd have an available digital copy of that comic book for yourself. So that let's say you're going on a trip on a plane or something like that. Well, you're not going to walk onto the plane with a stack of comics, you know, but you will walk on with your iPad or your other tablet device, and you'll be able to sit there and read your comic on your way to wherever you're going.
Right. Well, absolutely. But see, that's the thing. Like with iTunes, you could take the CDs you already had and rip them in and put them on your iPod.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have to just buy an iPod and then buy all brand new songs. But yet, with the movies, that's what they do. If you buy the DVD, sometimes you get it, and they'll give you a code, and you get the movie off iTunes.
Yeah, you can get the digital copies.
That's right.
But, well, and, you know, I think this is something we're going to see eventually come around in the next few years because of the popularity of things like the Kindle and other tablet reader devices. So I think the time of the digital comic is coming. Will it ever replace the printed comic? No, absolutely not.
Yeah, I don't think as far as popularity ever will either.
No.
I think it'd be more of a disposable entertainment. I mean, wouldn't mind if I had an iPad. A lot of people friends of mine have bought iPads because they want to read comics on them. I never liked, you know, reading comics on a computer because I don't like to sit there at the computer. I do that all day at work. And I never understood why people would want to rip a song to their computer. This is back in the 90s. My daughter said, my friend said you can put songs on the computer. Okay, good. Why? You know, you can't take them with you. I'm not carrying a computer everywhere. But then when the iPod came out, I still didn't quite understand the appeal of it. You know, I thought, well, I got a portable CD player, you know. And I was reading some little brochure Apple had, and it was interviewing people in Manhattan, where Yancey Street is. And it's they were talking to people about when they use their iPod. Most of them are using it, you know, when they rode the train back to wherever they lived. And they were asking, what do you keep on your iPod? And different people would mention several artists they keep on it. And this one guy was an architect that lived in Connecticut, rode the train. And they said, what do you have on your iPod? And he said, everything I own. And that changed it for me. I thought, you know, you go on a trip, you can bring everything. Same thing you mentioned about the comics. You can have your entire collection on an iPad. And I was interested to find out about the Marvel app, thinking I could get all those Jack Kirby Fantastic Fours. But I'm not paying, what, $3 a pop?
Right.
For 102 issues? I mean, you know, they're worth it. You know, if they were on the omnibus, I'd get them, you know. but I don't know, electronically.
You know, it's funny. You just made me realize that I actually have a copy of the Ghost Rider collection. Somebody bought it for me for a birthday a few years back. It's an all digital version. I think I've looked at it once. Now that I think about it, I've only looked at it once. But yet, a few months ago, I went through my comic book boxes and read the actual books.
Oh, yeah.
And that just comes from a lifetime of reading physical books for us.
Yeah. Like I said, you know, if I do go on a trip, I might, you know, download them onto my, you know, mobile devices and things and be able to read them. But other than that, it's, you know, it's just up in my comic book collection, right, sitting there.
Yeah, but that's the thing about some of these, you know, like I keep mentioning iPad, but I know there's other ones. There's other little pads that everybody has. That might be different. If you could take it and read it like you would a book and carry it around with you, that might change, and it's a larger image area. But right now, you know, I don't have one. I don't like to sit at the computer, and I don't like to look at a little tiny iPhone looking at comics. So, I don't know. It's something to think about. But yet, I do know one human being walking this earth, James, and he does read the comics on a computer. I've seen him, and I've heard him for years talk about that's how he prefers to look at them, even though he does buy some of his books of his favorites.
Thank you, James.
Well, hey, you know what? Let's throw it out to everybody who's listened to the podcast. You guys tell us, what do you read your comics as? Digital? Do you still go to the comic book shop and get them? Or do you get them mail order? What's your preference? You tell us.
Yeah, drop us a line on the blog. It's twodimensionpodcast.blogspot.com. That's two as in T-W-O. And then click on this episode, and after you listen to it, just jump right on the thread and tell us all about it.
Also, you go to the Facebook page. We have, I think, 4 or 5 members on it.
Yeah, it's like us.
Yeah. I think we're up to like 7 now.
Yeah, it might be. Yeah.
Anyway, but, you know, you can go on there and say all you want.
That's right. And it's facebook.com/...
Well, if you go to the blog, at the very bottom, there's a link to it. It's got the Facebook logo on it, so you can click from there.
That's even easier.
Woo-hoo!
Well, I guess that's about
another show.
That's about it for this episode, guys. I hope you really enjoyed listening to us. Drop us a line on the blog, and look out for the next episode. And until then, read more comics.